Yeah, so I, you know, was kind of, you know, I've been working in Kenya for many, many years, and I was curious about the Tarahumara. Pretty much everything I had read turned out not to be true. So I didn't see a single person barefoot, and I didn't see anybody running unless I asked them to run. You know, my Spanish was good enough that I heard her basically say, "Yeah, this gringo, he runs like 5 miles every morning," and just to kind of be good at running. And he like looked at me and he said, there's like some moments you just never forget. And I remember him looking at me and he said, "Why would anybody run if they didn't have to?"
Hey, before we get going with the podcast with Dr. Daniel Lieberman, we want to thank a couple of our show sponsors. First off, Exoskin. You can find them at exoskin.us. And it's getting warmer out there, Don. And maybe people don't want to have that full length tight on anymore. And Exoskin has you covered.
They have shorts in three different lengths, and that's the short, the midi, M-I-D-I, and the three-quarter length shorts. Or for some people, Scott, it's still cold out, and they need to be in tights.
Yeah, and they also have the three different lengths of tights. Go to exoskin.us, and you can get 20% off by using the code TRN. We also want to thank Doug Crumley at Ameriprise. He's our first Patreon business level supporter.
Doug was just out there showing how disciplined he is in his running. He was out this morning with his 15-year-old daughter, making sure he got his run in today.
She's on a mission. She's just fallen in love with trail running, and she's really a pleasure. She is my accountability partner.
When we want to do well at something, accountability partners are important. I imagine that's one of the things you do with financial consulting.
I think you nailed it. I think having someone that you can talk to, anytime, someone that's going to help you to collaboratively develop a plan, to develop goals, to utilize digital tools that you can access anytime to see how you are tracking towards that goals, has, you know, so many similarities with what we do towards achieving our running goals as well. There are tools that are available to us that we've had available to us for quite some time, but that are now available to the client so that they're accessible to them anytime and on any device. And so that really has helped them to be more fully engaged in their progress than ever before.
Doug Crumley, what is the number one comment you hear from your clients?
The number one comment that I hear from clients after they've completed, you know, their first year with us is they wish they had started doing this when they were in their 20s and 30s. And of course, you know, we're so busy doing other things at that phase of our lives, but that is such a common wish that people had done. And yet it's never too late to engage.
So take your finances to its greatest potential by getting in touch with Doug Crumley at Ameriprise.
How do we get a hold of you, Doug?
I think probably the easiest way is to visit our website at DougCrumleyJR.com. That's Doug, CrumleyJR.com.
And we'd also like to give special thanks to our Patreon members, Scott, because they're sponsors too.
They're helping push this cart along, and we appreciate them. We have three different levels that you can sign up for. If you go to our webpage and just click that Support Us tab, you can find all the benefits. One of the benefits is the bonus miles. If you sign up at the ambassador level, you get the recording after the recording. And there's a good one on this one, isn't there, Don?
They're all good, Scott. But we also have another request or offer that goes out to everybody. We're going to do another episode on Ask the Coaches. Instead of Scott and I coming up with the questions, we thought we'd have you call in to a number, get your voice heard on TRN, and ask the question directly yourself to the coaches.
This is what you're going to do. You're going to call this number, 916-258-5872, and you're going to leave your name, where you're calling from, and the short question you have for the coaches. And we may select that and actually play that clip on this upcoming episode with the coaches. The number again, 916-258-5872. And now on with the conversation with Dr. Lieberman, co-hosted by Dr. Mark Cucuzella.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
whoa!
Okay, are we ready?
Yeah, I'm recording. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman. And we have today, we have Dr. Mark Cucuzzella joining us as a co-host. Dr. Mark, welcome as the co-host team, usually a guest, but today a co-host. So welcome to the team.
Oh gosh, it's a privilege to be here with my friend, Dr. Daniel Lieberman. So we're here to interrogate him about his new book.
I'm delighted to be interrogated by the likes of you.
For those of you that are listening, you may have read the book Born to Run by Chris McDougall, and you recall how Chris referenced Dr. Lieberman and how humans were uniquely designed to run. Or if you've attended Harvard, which Scott and I did not, and you've taken a class on evolutionary biology, you may have learned from Professor Lieberman. Or if you subscribe to 2004 Scientific Journal, the article Endurance Running and the Evolution of Homo, and it was found in Nature, that article changed the way we look at about how humans have unique endurance characteristics. Dr. Lieberman is also an author. He has written the book, The Story of the Human Body, and recently the book titled Exercise, and we're going to talk about that book, Exercise, because Scott and I have read it, so has Dr. Cucuzzella, and well, heck, Dr. Lieberman wrote it, so I think we're in good shape. But first, we're going to talk about the runner, Dan Lieberman, and the first question I have for you is, were you a runner before you wrote the article for Nature or a runner after you wrote the article for Nature on how humans were designed to run?
Well, I kind of was a different kind of runner before that article. So As I described in the book Exercise, you know, I started running when I was a kid because my mother started running in the late 60s to liberate a gym at the University of Connecticut because they wouldn't let women use the gym. So she picked up running in order to force them to let women in the gym. She would run in it and they would kick her out, and she'd run it and they would kick her out. And eventually they let her stay because they had to, but it also got her addicted to running. So my parents started running. That was late 60s, before the running boom, really. And so I kind of thought it was sort of normal to run. And in high school, I would run because I was pretty hyperactive, but I was never really serious. And it wasn't until Dennis Bramble and I were working on the Born to Run paper in 2004 in Nature that I kind of kicked it up a notch. You know, I kind of, you know, studying the evolution of running and my own running, you know, it was like a feedback loop, right? You know, and the more I studied running, the more, because we spent 3 years writing that paper. And by the time I finished we finished that paper in 2004 and published it, I was kind of more seriously running. And then right after that, you know, I started getting invited to tons of running conferences. And that's actually when I first met Tim Noakes, actually, in 2005. And that's when I thought, well, I got to try marathon. And I've been doing it ever since.
And you've run quite a few, right? How many marathons have you completed?
Well, it depends on how you count them. But I would say, I think technically 24, you know, where I've actually put a number on my chest.
Wait a minute. Is there a different way to count marathons I'm not aware of? Maybe I've run quite a few marathons.
One of them was, you know, when they canceled the New York City Marathon, students organized a kind of like one over here along the Charles River. And I don't know whether to count that or not.
Oh, yeah, you count that. Absolutely. I would.
All right, then I'll count it.
You ran the miles, right?
Absolutely. Actually, I was an ultra because I ran to get to the start. And then, you know, so I actually probably ran like 27 miles that day, you know.
Wow. Okay.
Hey, so since 2004, that article, have you thought about it, changed anything, see some things that you've learned since then that you would do an addendum to? Or do you feel that was a solid piece of work that stands the test of time?
Gosh, in terms of what's in that paper, I think what's happened is that we really just added a lot to it, right? Because that kind of got it started, right? The paper's been cited, I think, almost 1,800, 1,900 times since then in the scientific literature. So there's a lot of papers that have come out since then. And we've learned a lot more. We've learned about, you know, genes. We've learned a lot more about the physiology. We've learned about other adaptations. So I would say it was like a start, but we've really sort of added a lot to it. But I don't think there's anything in there that I would take back yet, at least not yet.
Nice. The reason we have Dr. Mark Cucuzzella on the podcast is because he's a medical doctor, and he's here because he's our expert runner. He's been on our podcast probably a dozen times, and he's actually friends with Dan. That's how we got Dan on the podcast. I don't know what kind of of stuff he's holding over Dan, if he's blackmailing me on the podcast. but Mark, tell us about how you met Dan and how you guys have worked together.
Actually, I think I first came across Dan's work with the paper and Chris McDougall's work in Born to Run. I was in that kind of early minimalist movement, and it was a pretty small tribe. Then I think I first met you at the New York City Barefoot Run, which would have been maybe like 2012. And Dan had a shirt Evolved to Run, and it was kind of a more of a party, but you know, I think we all, you know, looked to Dan as our scientific guide on, right? So the rest of us were just either runners or, you know, you had like Barefoot Ted. They're people that are just doing this because they loved it, right? These are just exuberant Ken Bob. I mean, these are just exuberant people that just love to run. And maybe I think, you know, Dan explained it in the book is in relation to the Dharamara, you know, running is a form of prayer for these people. So I mean, I sense that there was something to that. And I gave a talk with Dan and Irene Davis. I think this was after that. So at the Boston Marathon, you know, so we needed to be a little more legit and not wear tie dyes at the Boston Marathon Sports Med Conference. So they asked me to do a talk with Dan and Irene, the organizers, about minimalist and barefoot running. And I kind of respectfully said, well, I wear, you know, I'd run in minimal shoes and had never run barefoot. And but they wanted me to do that talk more about kind of the style or art of it versus the science of it. I'm a family doc, so I don't do much stuff in the lab. I've been to Dan's lab, which is fascinating, and did an experiment up there, you know, on cadence and VO2 max and trying to find that sweet spot, you know, of where your optimum efficiency is. Maybe we talk right. A little bit about that, like run too slow, you're inefficient, run too fast, you're inefficient. We all have this sweet spot that's probably a little different for all of us. And that was an interesting experiment to do. But so I took my shoes off and started running barefoot. And I found also that there was just kind of almost a spiritual thing about that. I shared a movie as my part of my talk. Like I had a friend just shoot like a 4-minute video on barefoot running just to show what it was. And it wasn't about performance. It wasn't about injury prevention. It was just about just rediscovering how to move properly. That was kind of my hypothesis, was why I ran barefoot, was you land different. And maybe if you can learn how to run in that kind of style, maybe you can keep running, you know, into the nursing home. So that was almost 10 years ago. And I, knock on wood, I haven't had any overuse running injuries since then. I did break my toe pretty bad this summer running in sandals on the Appalachian Trail. So that's I had my, you know, hierarchies up there, and I caught my foot on a root and my toe went one direction and my body went the other. But I did tape it up and was able to finish that 100-mile run with a broken toe. But so, yeah, and then, you know, I've followed, I think, the most influential work that Dan has put out there, you know, in my field is the story of the human body. Because, you know, what I deal with every day is what Dan wrote about there, which is mismatch diseases. You know, so we're a human organism, a human species, you know, designed to live by certain principles. And we're put into an environment now which is completely incongruent to human health and longevity. You know, I'd say 80% of what I see is chronic disease. I mean, you could even put COVID in that category, because the ones who hit the hospital are the ones with some type of chronic disease. And I wrote a paper on that just got accepted, and it took 9 months to get that paper accepted. Mm. It's like, why aren't people talking about that? Like, if we have the opportunity now to have a public health initiative to restore human health in a Manhattan Project type of way, like the vaccine development, but we're completely missing that opportunity. But the story of the human body is really what I've been. And Dan gave a talk maybe 2015 at the Boston Marathon. And this was just revolutionary thinking, you know, and I still use this with med students, because he asked the question, are we designed to be healthy? You know, everyone there is like a sports med doc, right? They're, it's like, yeah, of course we're all designed to be healthy, right? It's like, no, we're designed to survive and, you know, reproduce. So energy in, babies out. Isn't that what you say?
That's my equation, energy
in, babies out. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, And that's exercise. So I think you'd already written Story of the Human Body at that point. So maybe that thinking was the beginnings of exercise, because that was, you know, we're not designed to wake up and want to go run on a treadmill. But yeah, we've had I've been to Dan's house several times before the Boston Marathon, you know, and shared a meal and a glass of wine. And, you know, Dan, I was explaining to these.
Hopefully we'll do it again one of these days.
October.
That's right.
It's like
the
Holiday Inn Express moment.
I got invited to give a lecture with the Boston Squeakers. I'm a Boston Squeaker. I could barely qualify. So we'll see if I make it in this year.
Hey, yeah, so it's October, what is it, 11th maybe?
I think the 12th. It's Columbus Day weekend.
Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I love the recent paper on the way the arms move is fascinating, you know, because I watch how, I mean, even think about it now, and I've always been working on that counter rotation, but there's real reasons that we do that. But that's the short story.
Well, Dan, one of the reasons we wanted to get you on is because of the new book that you just released last year called Exercised, with a D on the end, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Tell us, where did the title come from? Why Exercised with a D?
Because, I mean, the real basic argument of the book is that, you know, we've medicalized and commercialized, industrialized, commodified physical activity as exercise. And it works for a few people, but for most people it doesn't, you know. And you know, to be exercised means to be confused and anxious and ambivalent and worried, you know, and kind of irritated, right, about something. And we've made something so simple and so fundamental, we've made people really exercised about it. And so the basic idea of the book is to take an anthropological and evolutionary approach to physical activity to try to help us be a little more compassionate and a little bit more sensible and make people less exercised about exercise. So it's, you know, it's a play on words. So it's a natural history of exercise with the intent of trying to help us do better, to help each other move.
One of the things that came to mind came to my mind as I listened to your book is you probably said it. And then I probably thought, oh, I just discovered that, when really I just listened to it. And that's the fact that you spoke about calories as a commodity. It's like, so the hunter-gatherers are out there, they're gathering and working to gather their calories. Why would someone go out and run a 5-mile loop or get on a treadmill and spend an hour on it when that cost calories? Right. And so they commoditized their calories, or thought of it that way. And I thought that was an interesting way to think about this problem, exercise.
Well, I mean, I think another way of thinking about it is that there are certain things in the world, certain variables, that are limited, right? So the most obvious one is time, right? The time that we're spending yakking with each other is time that we really could spend with our families, right? or running, or, you know, making money, or the time people are spending listening to this is time that they could spend, you know, doing something, you know, more productive, right? So, you know, every time you spend a minute on something, you don't spend that minute on something else, right? That's obvious, right? Mm-hmm. But it turns out that in most societies, and, you know, America today in the 21st century is an exception, calories were just as limited as time, right? And people struggle to get enough calories. So, you know, I went for a 5-mile run this morning, kind of like a recovery run this morning. So I spent about 500 calories, you know, jogging around the Charles River. And if I were energy limited, that would be a really stupid thing to do, right? Because that's 500 calories that I'm not spending on either reproduction or maintenance or something that natural selection actually cares about. So until recently, when people were energy limited, it made sense to avoid unnecessary exertion, right? You know, so people were physically active when they needed to be. And they were physically active when it was rewarding, like, you know, like play is rewarding, dancing is rewarding. You know, you can find a mate or can keep your mate attracted to you or something like that. But, you know, going to the gym and lifting weights for the sole purpose of lifting a weight, or going for a run for the sole purpose of running, right, for health and fitness, which is what exercise is something that nobody did until recently, like reading. Nobody also read until recently either. These are all modern behaviors.
Tell us the story of when you went down to the Copper Canyons in Mexico to study the Tarahumara And the running people, right? That's what they're called, as the running people. Tell us that story. You mentioned it in the book, and I think it's just fascinating.
Yeah. So I've been working in Kenya for many, many years, and I was curious about the Tarahumara, which I had first read about from a paper that Scott Carrier had written about. Went to Ironman, and then right after I went to the medical conference, and then right after Ironman, I was on sabbatical, and I went and did several weeks of field work with the Tarahumara to study their running. And I was being a good anthropologist, and I had my set of questions and whatever. And I was immediately struck by the fact that pretty much everything I had read turned out not to be true. So I didn't see a single person barefoot, and I didn't see anybody running unless I asked them to run. and I expected to see all these barefoot people just running around all over the place. And of course, as an anthropologist, you kind of like, okay, yeah, that was obviously a stupid thing. But anyway, so, and I was asking people about their running, and I found out that most people only ran occasionally, and that people didn't train. And I was working with a translator, trying to find out about, you know, how, because there were a few people who were serious runners. Most of them are not. And there was this one elderly guy, and everybody told me, you know, oh yeah, he's a really great runner, you know? And so I was excited to talk to him. And I was asking about training, and the translator I was working with, her name was Sara. She was struggling, my Spanish was good enough that I heard her basically say, yeah, this gringo, he runs like 5 miles every morning and just to kind of be good at running. And he like looked at me and he said, there's like some moments you just never forget. And I remember him looking at me and he said, why would anybody run if they didn't have to? And I kind of laughed out of embarrassment because, yeah, that made total sense, you know? And I realized that, you know, the kind of training that we do in the West is unusual. It's kind of a strange Western thing. And that was that. Just at that moment, I was finishing up the story of the human body. I kind of thought, okay, that's going to be my next book, because we need to write a book about how, because the first book I wrote really was about how we never evolved to be healthy. And I realized that the next book was, we never evolved to exercise. You know, we evolved to be physically active, but we never evolved to exercise. And that's when that germ just kind of hit me. And when I was working on the book, I thought, yeah, I'll put that in the, you know, I'll tell it like it was, you know, that was really the moment. That kind of sparked the book.
Yeah. So Dan, on that line of the exercise, you know, I'd love to hear maybe it's an observation, just what you've experienced. So how, you know, I think you mentioned 20% of people meet those 150 ACSM, you know, suggested physical activity, but how do we get kids to actually want to do this now, you know, without exercising them, you know, in some regimented way, like, because we're so mismatched now. Are we past the point of no return? That
we're still the same. We're all cut out of the same cloth, you know. Scratch. We're all the same, right? Look, I think we should look. We live in a world where people no longer have to be physically active because we've created all these machines that do our work for us, right? I mean, just think about the simple act of getting water, right? We just think it's just normal. You just turn the tap and you got water, right? But until recently, to get water, that meant you had to go to the well or you had to go to a stream and carry it, right? This, the idea that water just comes from a tap, you know, we just think it's normal, but it isn't. Or just, you know, you just turn the dial and that unless you live in Texas right now, you know, and then the heat goes up, right? You know? So everything we do now has been made so easy for us. And so we now have to do something really weird, which is we have to choose to be physically active. So I think that the trick is to make exercise, to treat it the way we treat education, right? How do we get kids to go to school, which is also something abnormal? I mean, nobody did that in the Paleolithic, go to school or learn to read, right? We make it necessary and we also make it rewarding, right? Because school is fun and also necessary. And you know, you see your friends and you get to play and you get to do music and you get to do other fun stuff, but you also have to do some serious stuff. And if you don't do it, the teacher gives you a bad grade or tells your parents, right? And think about it on my level, right? I'm a professor at Harvard where people pay an obscene amount of money to come to Harvard, right? They compete viciously to get into Harvard so they can spend $65,000 a year to have me torture them. And if they're paying, and if I don't like what they write, you know, their exams questions, I give them a low grade and they're paid for me to do that to them, right? That's called a commitment contract. So I think that we can we can use that kind of educational sort of paradigm for exercise. Let's make it necessary, but also let's make it rewarding. Now, of course, for kids, you can make it necessary by forcing them, right? Because we can do that to kids. You can't force adults. So I think the way we can make it necessary for adults is through commitment contracts. Mark, you know, my friend Aaron, right, who I often run with, you know, we text each other in the evening. We say, hey, let's meet tomorrow at 6 a.m. And I can guarantee you tomorrow at 6 a.m. I do not want to meet him. No way. It's going to be dark and cold and miserable. And I'd much rather be in bed with my wife. But Aaron's going to be waiting for me and he'll kill me if I don't go. Right. So I'm going to get out there at 6 a.m. and I'll probably be really irritated at first. But, you know, after a mile or so, we'll warm up and then I'm always glad to have done it afterwards. So we find other ways. Almost everyone who's a runner, maybe everyone who's a runner finds ways to kind of, you know, self-coerce in a kind of, you know, way. We we're always glad we did it, but it's always hard to get out the door. I mean, it's almost always hard to get out the door. So I think there are many, many ways we can do that. And you know, the sky's the limit, but the best ways are making it social.
And absolutely. When it's social, it's a lot of fun. I know that when Scott and I run together, the time goes by much faster and we come back and we go, we need to keep this up because it's so much easier. And one of the things I was thinking as I was listening to Exercised was that when we start off with a new exercise program, you said it needs to be rewarding, but sometimes it's just too hard to start. You get injured because you start off too fast. Your brain still thinks you're 25 and you're actually not. And it's just difficult, but we should be able to give ourselves permission to go easy, to start off easy, not to make it hard. Just be active for 30 minutes or 45 minutes, get your heart rate up, stay healthy, come back, enjoy it, have fun, because your ability to go out longer and stronger and faster is going to build in time and you'll still enjoy it. But starting off too hard is, I think, a recipe for disaster and an America that sits on their couch because it's just too hard to exercise, and it shouldn't be.
That's right. And also, I think we kind of give people some unrealistic goals. So sure, you know, if you're new to something, you can't go out and run a marathon or let alone an ultra marathon, right? That's crazy, right? And in fact, humans never evolved to stand on one line and run 26.2 miles to another line as fast as possible. I mean, that's the fact that we can do it is amazing. But that's not you know, running 100 miles, no way did we evolve to do that, right? That's just really, really silly. So, but we have this expectation now because of the way we glamorize, right, and commodify and sort of whatever, that somehow if you don't get out of bed and run an ultra marathon, then you're kind of a nobody, right? And you know, it's fine if you can do it and if you enjoy doing it, that's great, but I think a lot of the kind of overdoing it comes from kind of just this sort of expectations that people have.
Dan, do you jump out of bed in the morning to go for a run?
Me? No. Absolutely not. I whine and moan and bitch and complain. My wife, I promise you, can tell you, I can't tell you how many mornings, especially, you know, like, oh, I don't really want to go for a run or whatever. And I, you know, and whatever. And I finally, you know, she's like, get the hell out of here, you know? So sometimes it's, but I'm always glad I did it, but I find it hard to get started. And I think that's true of most of us. I mean, how about you guys?
It takes me, Dan, full confession, I think about an hour before, you know, I wake up and I need, it's one cup, two cups. Oh, I'll read that article. And then I look at the, wait for the sun to come up, but I'm always glad I'm out the door. Yeah.
But you read books where that make you feel like there's somehow, if you don't feel like just jumping out of bed and running an ultra marathon, that you're somehow there's something wrong with you. And I think that's what I call the myth of the athletic savage, right? This idea that people who are uncontaminated by civilization, right? They don't have Gatorade and shoes and, you know, Garmin watches or whatever, like, you want to think of, right? That somehow they just naturally want to do incredible physical activity and it's just easy for them. And it's just like, and you know, it's just as hard for them as it is for us. And, you know, I think that's one of the problems with the way in which the Tarahumara have been portrayed. The Tarahumara, which, you know, the reason that they're incredible runners, and some of them are, is because they care about it, because it's a form of prayer. It's spiritual. But that's not what people read about in that book. And I think we need to kind of set the record straight that, you know, it's just as hard for them as it is for us. They have nausea and cramps and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're all the same. We're all human beings.
I think the big one of the big takeaways from the book that I got is that that is anthropologically, we're all in the same boat. That we don't. It's okay to not want to jump out of bed in the morning and lace up our shoes. It's okay that we don't want to take the stairs instead of the escalator, right? And I appreciate that because sometimes I feel like I need to remove the label on my chest that says I'm a runner because sometimes I just don't want to go out there and run. And what I got from your book is, yeah, keep the label on your chest. You are a runner because you're going to go out and you're going to do it. And to your point, Dan, when you finish, I don't think I've ever done a run where I was finished and I thought, well, that was a waste of time.
Yeah, even the 2018 Boston Marathon.
Oh, we need to hear that story. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, that was the famous, you know, nor'easter. I mean, you ran it too, Mark.
Yes, with like
that was layers. Unquestionably the most miserable running experience of my life. You know, it was like just above freezing. It was like 3 inches of rain.
Good day. You had a good time. All things relative.
Did I? I don't remember. I just remember moving. Getting home.
I went right to a sauna. My friend had a room at the park. It was that one right on the corner there of the Commons, and they had a sauna. I just went right to that sauna. And
I remember after that run, I was like so cold, I couldn't even change, right? I got onto the – normally after the marathon, I like to walk to Park Street.
Normal behavior.
And yeah. I, you know, walk across the park and then take the subway home to Cambridge. But I was so cold, I just – and I got onto one of those like Grant – totally jam-packed little subways, the Green Line, and there was a guy right in front of me who vomited, and I remember thinking, it's warm. I didn't mind. It was warm vomit.
It's like the mountaineers, you know, when you're putting in your sleeping bag, it warms you up. You're like, oh, that feels really good.
It was a tough marathon.
Shift gears a little bit, but, you know, one of the important things I think, you know, maybe you could elucidate it for the listeners, Dan, is, you know, there's always this in the media, you know, exercise for the calories to lose weight, you know, and burn in. But, you know, you really spoke about the inflammation, you know, the morbidity, mortality, you know, disease and you know, what's happening with exercise outside of like burning energy, you know, I mean, who wants to burn energy? But, you know, maybe just share some of, because I think maybe that's something that helps someone get out of bed as they're getting to 50 and 60, even that 20 or 30 minutes, you know, the power that run is doing for that. They don't know what's going on under the hood, but it's like miracle stuff.
Yeah. So the biggest sort of mechanism that causes chronic disease is a phenomenon called inflammation. And it's basically your immune system acting at a slow burn. So, you know, like if you get a cut, right, and you get that redness and swelling and heat, et cetera, that, you know, from a cut, that's an acute inflammatory response to the infection or the cut or the damage that you've done in a little spot. But inflammation can also occur kind of all over your body at a very, very low level that you can't see, you can't feel. But it's pernicious. It's what causes causes atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries. It causes Alzheimer's. It's basically what causes diabetes and sort of metabolic syndrome. You know, it causes arthritis. It causes most of the diseases, the chronic diseases that kind of destroy our kind of health and cause, you know, illness and you know, billions of medical dollars and all that, right? And it turns out that one of the best ways to control inflammation, well, there's two important ways. One is to prevent obesity, because obesity is a major cause of inflammation, especially visceral fat, the belly fat. So exercise is really important in preventing weight gain. So, you know, there are debates about how well you can lose weight exercising, and there's a section in the book of that. But one of the key things that nobody debates is that exercise is really important in preventing weight gain or weight regain. So that's one half of the equation. But it's a double whammy, because the other side of the equation is that when you exercise, you're using skeletal muscle, and it turns out that the major molecules that regulate inflammation are not produced We always used to think they were produced by white blood cells, but it turns out that muscles also produce those molecules. They're called cytokines. So when they're produced by muscles, they're called myokines. And you have so much muscle in your body, you produce way more of them when you're active with skeletal muscle than your white blood cells do. And so those muscles, turning on your muscles, regulates your inflammatory system and turns it down. So when you're exercising, you actually depress levels of systemic inflammation. And that's one of the major reasons it's so important in terms of preserving health. It regulates and calms down and prevents the systemic inflammation that is so pernicious. And there's no pill you can take for that. You know, there's only one pill. It's called exercise. And it also turns on, you produce antioxidants. I mean, there's 1,000 other repair and maintenance mechanisms that you turn on when you exercise nothing else that we can do that has all those benefits.
Can you elucidate a little more about the visceral fat? A lot of folks don't know what that is, but that's that, you know, we look at BMI in medicine, which is, you know, height, which is the equation, you know, it's height per weight,
height squared over weight. So there's two kinds of fat. So there's subcutaneous fat, which is the fat that's underneath your skin, right? You know, in your cheeks and under your triceps. You know, by the way, the name of the fat here under your triceps. No, it's called that's called the mobile wad of Henry. But anyway, so that's the loose fat underneath your triceps. But anyway, there's your fat all over your body, but then there's fat that's around your organs, right? Like around your liver and around your heart and, you know, around your gut, your visceral. And that's called visceral fat. And visceral fat turns out to be, it's much more hormone sensitive, and it's also directly basically plumbed into your portal vein. So it goes straight to your liver. So visceral fat is much more inflammatory than subcutaneous fat. It's because it's much more active. And when fat is stored in little cells called adipocytes. And when those adipocytes, you know, as you get more and more fat, right, those adipocytes swell. And at a certain point, like anything else that swells, they burst, right? They get damaged. And when the adipocytes get too big and they get damaged, then they attract white blood cells. Because there's injury, right? There's damage, right? So there's an inflammatory response. And the white blood cells start, you know, producing all kinds of chemicals that create an inflammatory response that's really pernicious. And so what exercise helps you do is prevents you from getting all that visceral fat and keeps those cells from getting too big so that you don't end up getting that particular kind of damage. Plus, it also causes your muscles to turn on other molecules, which then also damp down that inflammatory response as well. So you get kind of two independent benefits from physical activity that prevent and help regulate that kind of inflammatory response, which is real. So that's why, for example, if you're worried about Alzheimer's, by far the best way to prevent Alzheimer's, which is an inflammatory disease, is exercise. Exercise reduces your risk of Alzheimer's by at least 30%. Nothing on the planet has ever come close to that. Many cancers, like breast cancer, colon cancer, etc., are all, you know, they're probably, which also are related to inflammation. Their likelihood, your risk of cancers goes down by 30, 40, 50, 60% in some individuals. I could go on, you know, arthritis, metabolic syndrome, you know, diabetes, all of these are inflammatory diseases. And it's one of the reasons why physical activity is so important in preventing those diseases.
So what's the dose that we need to take? Can we get away with 20 minutes, like Dr. Mark said, or do we have to be out there for an hour and a half? What's a dose, doctor?
So there's a whole chapter on dose in the book, and of course, curious to hear Mark's opinion. But there, that's part of the problem with medicalizing exercise, is that people want to know what's the dose, but there is no one dose. It depends on who you are, right? Are you young? Are you old? Are you fit? Are you not fit, etc.? What we know is that there's basically a curve, right? If you take large samples, right? If you're completely inactive, and if you graph sort of how much activity you do on one axis, and sort of it's outcome effect on the y-axis. It's kind of a parabolic curve. And what happens is that at very low doses, i.e. none, your risk is very high. And even a little bit lowers your dose a lot, lowers your risk a lot. So 60 minutes of exercise a week, by most estimates, again, these are large population studies, lowers your relative rate of mortality by about 30 to 40%, which is that's 8 minutes a day, right? That's pretty effective, right? 150 minutes a week, which is the standard WHO, you know, AHA, you know, recommendation, that lowers your mortality rate by about 50%. And then it keeps going down, but eventually it tails off, right? And eventually there's really no extra benefit. And the only debate there is whether or not you can exercise too much. And actually there's really essentially no evidence that you can exercise too much, although people keep saying it. But there actually a paper just came out from the UK Biobank study with a really big study with lots of data. And to this date, there's really no compelling evidence that, you know, people who do ultramarathons, for example, are putting themselves at extra risk in terms of mortality. But the sample size out there at that end of the curve is so small, yeah. You know, it's very hard to be really sure.
I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, you hear all these myths like, oh, you're going to, you know, run yourself into the grave if you do too much. But, you know, Dan asked like what my take is on this, just working in the world, you know, and seeing patients. So I have medical patients, then I have people who come to my shoe store. So what I've observed is the right dose is what brings you joy. And George Sheehan wrote about this in like 1972. He was a runner, right? That was his form of prayer. And he said the first 30 minutes was for his physical, all the fancy stuff that Dan talks about with the cytokines. And then the other 30 minutes was for his mind, because that was, you know, that was what gave him the endocannabinoids or whatever, endorphins. I think, I don't know if Sheehan made up the runner's high. He wrote about that, but that was, you know, so for him, clearly that 60 minutes a day wasn't over the top. That was giving him his joy, yeah, which probably had something powerful
absolutely
for the rest of his life, but he probably didn't get much medical benefit. But we're not just a bunch of mitochondria. I mean, I think the brain is probably captain of the ship in some ways. And, you know, if you wake up and want to do it tomorrow, if you don't want to do it tomorrow, whatever dose that is, it's not the right dose. You know, it's the right dose is what you want to wake up and do tomorrow. But maybe, Dan, now that you're on the other side of 50 with me, you know, and we're probably evolved because our purpose on the earth is probably not, you know, it's limited now, and you have the grandparent chapter, but do we have to start changing what we do now and after 50 to be able to, you know, stay healthy, even though that's not in our DNA to keep going?
Well, no, but it is in our DNA to keep going. So, I mean, I think one of the most important, I think for me, my favorite chapter in the book is that chapter 10, where I talk about aging, because I believe, and I make the argument, that we evolved to be grandparents. It's a unique thing in humans, right? We evolved to live several decades after we stopped reproducing, not to kick up our heels and do nothing. It's quite the reverse. We evolved in order to be physically active so that we could forage and gather and get food and whatever and provision our children and our grandchildren. And when you do that, of course, you're turning on repair and maintenance mechanisms that fight senescence, that slow senescence, and that keep you healthy, extend health span, which by definition, therefore, extends lifespan. And so it's not coincidental that study after study after study shows that the health benefits of physical activity, of exercise, actually get bigger as you get older, not less. So the famous Paffenberger study, that was the first big, huge, major epidemiological study of the effects of exercise on longevity, showed that that people who were in their, you know, 20s, 30s, and 40s who were very physically active had, you know, death rates that were like 20% lower than less active individuals, but in their 70s and 80s, their death rates were 50% lower, right? Mm-hmm. And in between, you know, it's intermediate, right? And we kind of know some of the reasons why that's the case. And so now we live in this strange world where kind of people think, well, yeah, I'm in my 50s, I'm in my 60s, time to relax. But no, it's quite the reverse. It's the time that you should definitely get into gear. But as we were talking about earlier with dose, you don't need a crazy dose, right? You don't need to run marathons to get the benefits of exercise. You just, you know, 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day is actually a pretty sensible dose, and it'll do you a lot of benefit. If you're willing to do more, you'll get a little bit more out of it, but you don't need to do insane amounts of physical activity in order to get an enormous, enormous health benefit.
Along those same lines, and I don't know if it was in chapter 10 or not, because I wasn't turning the pages, I'm listening. And you brought up a study about in hunter-gatherer type environments, they measure the walking rate of the young, and then in the Western society, the walking rate of 60 and 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds, and how it really slows down. But it doesn't slow down in the environment where they're hunters and gatherers. Staying active, you stay fit, you stay mobile, you stay productive. You know, the candle burns bright to the end, all that stuff. Can you speak to that a little bit? And even Dr. Mark.
So that was actually a study done by Herman Ponzer, my former grad student, who measured the walking speed of Hadza as they age. And I can tell you, I followed some Hadza grandmothers out there, and boy, they walk on a really serious clip. You know, you don't dawdle behind them. You got to keep up, right? And and they're walking like 5 miles a day. They're digging for several hours a day. They're carrying stuff. They're not crazy physically active, but they stay very active. Their grip strength stays strong as they get older, because they don't remember, muscle is use it or lose it thing, right? And there's an adaptive reason for, because you don't want extra muscle, it's expensive. So you want enough muscle to do the things you need to do, but you don't want any more than that. So muscle is very responsive to how you use it. And so they stay physically active, and that keeps them healthy and happy. But we know that one of the biggest predictors of health outcomes is how fast you walk. So as people get frail, as they get older, they slow down, right? And they have trouble getting out of chairs and all that kind of stuff. And that turns out to be pretty predictive of your longevity, your health outcome, your expected lifespan at that point. So, you know, it's more of a marker than a cause, but it's kind of evidence of just how important staying active is throughout your life. Keeps you fit and healthy, and keeps you active. And the more you are, and what happens is that if you become frail and you become inactive, then you set in motion a vicious circle, right? Because then you end up doing less, and then when you end up doing less, you become less fit, and so the cycle goes.
Quick question. One of the things that I also came away with is a different opinion or assumption that these hunter-gatherer societies may actually be more active than we are here in 2021. Can you tell us what you found through your studies there?
Well, again, I'm citing the work of my former students, because the data on the Hadza come from Herman Ponzer and Dave Reichlin. They're the ones who collected the data. I'm just reporting it. I've had the chance to go out and spend time with the Hadza, but it's their data, not my data. So I don't want to claim it's my research. But they found, by just putting heart rate monitors and accelerometers and stuff on these folks, right? And of course, we've done studies on farmers and stuff like that, but this is on hunter-gatherers, that they're in terms of moderate to vigorous physical activity. So that means a 50% of maximum heart rate or more. They're basically spending about 2.25 hours a day on MVPA, moderate to vigorous physical activity. You know, that's like a brisk walk or more. And it's mostly moderate. There's not much vigorous. I think it's like 15 to 20 minutes of vigorous and like, you know, 2 hours of moderate physical activity a day. That's not a huge amount. You know, it's more than most Americans, but it's not a huge amount. So it turns out if you're an average American who's maybe doing 20 to 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity a day, not necessarily exercising, but just, you know, getting to the bus or, you know, that kind of stuff. If they just added an hour of serious walking a day, they wouldn't be too far off from a Hadza. You know, there'd still be a little bit less, but the thing is, you know, we're just, you know, the Hadza are, by different estimates, they're between about 6 to 10 times more active than your average American. But it doesn't take a huge amount of extra activity to get up to the level of the Hadza. And again, it's not like they're CrossFit workout types, you know, or they're, you know, doing marathons. They're just moderately active. They're doing, you know, 10,000-15,000 steps a day, you know.
The people cleaning my hospital get 25,000 steps a day.
Well, they should do more. They need to do more cleaning than walking.
You must have a big hospital.
No, we don't. It's a three-story hospital, but they get 20. They're just constantly.
They're hardworking. Yeah,
they're working. So they're like crushing the hospital.
You know, Don.
Oh, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, Don, I may be taking this out of your mouth, but as Don and I were on our run today discussing this, he said, you know, it's just the simple things. Instead of going and having someone wash your car yourself. You know, instead of driving the quarter mile or half mile to the grocery store, walk there and then carry your groceries back home. It just some simple changes could really make a dramatic change.
Absolutely. I mean, just think about, like, one of the strange things about the modern world today is how little we carry anything. I mean, how often do people carry anything, right? Maybe they might put a little backpack on and that's about it. But, you know, we have shopping carts in the grocery, right? We have strollers for our babies. You know, our suitcases are on wheels. I mean, you know, we just don't carry anything anymore. And yet for most of human evolution, people carried stuff all day long. They carried their babies. They carried their food. They carried their water. They carried their firewood. They carried everything. It's just like, it's just life, right? You know, we have this kind of weird world where we don't walk, we don't carry, we don't do anything. We don't have to, I don't even have to brush my teeth anymore, right? I could just use a machine, right? It's pretty impressive.
When I go back to flying for work, I'm gonna break the wheels off my roller bag, and I'm never gonna take those moving sidewalks. That's my new commitment.
Well, I find in airports, I just take the stairs anyway because it's faster, because you can get to the front of the line.
I had a question for Dan at my store today with my shoe buddies. I asked, well, what question should I ask Dan? And they're, well, gosh, you got to ask him about the shoes, right? Because we can't let Dan off the hook with, we've talked about all this health stuff, but now this is about the shoes. So what are your thoughts about, you know, I mean, people call them the cheater shoes, the next percent, you know, which put the foot out of a natural evolutionary position, maybe for one day of performance, but what would your hypothesis be if someone just started training in those as their daily trainer? Not specifically.
Are you talking about the Superfly?
I don't know what Alpha Fly, Next Percent, whatever they're funny. Called. Yeah, because they have a ton of toe spring, and they're, you know, a ton of, they got, I mean, they're not, they don't look like a foot.
No, they're pretty impressive.
They
so
we actually
started doing some experiments on them. And the experiments were halted by the pandemic. We actually were studying the Harvard track team because the Harvard track team all had a pair. And
they wore them in NCAA regionals or something.
Yeah. So we were doing a repeated measure study, and actually one of the students in the lab was on the team and whatever. And we started getting this experiment going because we were interested in the biomechanics of these shoes and kind of testing them out independently. And sadly, that was all destroyed by the shutdown. But my understanding of the shoe is that there's a bunch of things going on, but one of them is that they've essentially added, there's this carbon plate in there that in addition to the different shape of the shoe, there's also this carbon plate that essentially adds another spring-like element to the foot, right? So and people I know who wear them, I've never tried them, tell me that they're really, you know, it's hard on the Achilles, right? You know, you have to have really strong calf muscles. And the data that's been published suggests that they save about, you know, they can they can reduce your energetic cost by between 3-5%, you know, which is pretty impressive. And the only way to do that really is to either decrease the amount of work you do for propulsion or increase the amount of elastic energy storage, right? That's how the mechanics of running works. And it sounds to me from the data I've seen that it's probably more the latter, but it could be a kind of a function of two, because it really does get you up on your toes too. So but you know, it's the sad thing is that you know, it just kind of sticks in my craw, to be honest, because you know, running is such a basic fundamental thing. And if you add technology and like one person has this fancy shoe that, you know, he or she can get because Nike sponsors them and everybody else can't get it, that's not fair, right? That's might as well like add a jetpack onto them too, right? I mean, it's impressive. It's amazing. But there's a kind of, you know, when here's another way of thinking about it. When the 4-minute mile was broken, right, by
Bannister,
Roger Bannister. Thank you. I'm having a senior moment here, right? I mean, he just, you know, it was him and Chris Brasher, and I can't remember the other fellow who was helping him, and they were, thank you. And they were just like, you know, on their lunch break, you know, it was three guys, you know.
He rounded in the hospital that morning.
Right. You know, just
had a sandwich and took the train.
Just working their heart out to kind of achieve this goal. And now we have this, you know, there was no commercial sponsorship, you know. I mean, yeah, he went to some guy in London who made shoes for him out of like alligator skin or something. I can't remember what the kind of shoe was made out of. But you know, that was about it, right? Whereas now you have an entire corporate sponsorship, you know, and you know, 30, 40, 50 people, you know, involved in this, you know, in this. And it's exciting and it's fun, but it's a totally different thing, right? It's corporate. Right. You know, and the magic and the individualism, you know, it's not to say that Eliud Kipchoge is not an amazing athlete. He is, you know, an incredible person. And he seems like a great ambassador for the sport, but it's just not the same thing. Right. You know, and the other thing I would ask is, OK, so let's just say somebody runs under 2 hours in a legitimate time. That'll be fun. It'll be exciting. I'll be cheering them on, too. But okay, how's that going to change the world, right? It's not really, you know, it's nice, but you know, we have such serious concerns right now on the planet. What if we spent that money on, you know, alleviating poverty in the same part of the world where Kipchoge comes from and sending people to school? And you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is there are trade-offs, and that's just another one of them.
Yeah, where we put our attention is where action happens. And so if you're putting your attention on the 2 hour mark or some achievement like that, you're overlooking things that are immediate that need attention, like clean water and food and education, healthcare, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time you do something, you're not doing something else. Yeah.
Right.
What Dan mentions there, I think it hits a kind of a chord for me too, is just that, you know, just that spiritual nature of watching these runners run on an equal playing ground. I think it was 2011, Dan, when Geoffrey Mutai ran 2:03 and Moses Masop was like right on his heels.
Oh, that was an amazing finish.
Was 2:04. And they're all wearing some brand of slipper. So they were all, whatever it was, Adidas or Nike, they're all basically had the same nothing on their feet. And just watching. And it was that no one was saying, oh, someone had a better shoe. I mean, there was a little tailwind, and that was the only conversation. Well, maybe it wasn't legit because it was point to point in a tailwind, but there was no, it was clean and it was pure, and it was just amazing to watch run that day. But it's sad that I don't think we'll ever have a day that you could just have that, okay, who the best man won or the best woman won on this equal playing field day, because they're all going to talk about Adidas has the shoe now. Is that better than the Nike shoe? And but unless someone regulates it, I guess there's no going back, you know,
I also think, you know, part of the commercialization and commodification of running is it's like with all sports that we're, you know, look, I'm as excited as anybody else to watch these amazing athletes run these incredible speeds and at these distances, you know, it's fun. And as a runner, I really appreciate it, enjoy it. But I do worry that the attention that they get can maybe be also have a negative effect, right? Because there's, you know, I wonder if it's a bit like supermodels. Like, you know, when we pay so much attention to supermodels and that it gives us a kind of distorted view of you know, what beauty should be like. And I wonder if, you know, if there are people out there who think, oh my God, I can't run a 440 mile for 1 mile, let alone 26 miles. I'm not going to bother, you know, that there's, there's so much attention paid to these exceptional extreme athletes that it's almost kind of deflating. I wonder, this is a hypothesis. I'm not, it's a question, but I wonder if it, cause you know, the average, you know, the person who's running a 4 hour marathon, right. You know, coming in 2 hours later after Mutai and Kipchoge and all that, they're still doing something amazing and wonderful and exciting, and they're happy. And, you know, you can see that every kind of human being can cross the finish line. You see tall people and short people and big people and small people and, you know, every size and shape of human being. Right. And we need to celebrate that too. And you know, they're having a great time, but we're all then focused on the few people in the front. And so again, I'm not opposed to races and I'm, you know, or opposed to the, you know, chasing the two-hour marathon, but I think maybe the relative amount of attention sometimes might have a negative consequence.
I love the spirit of the runner. Scott and I have had a nice opportunity over the years to be at the finish line to do some announcing, and that every runner that comes through has that internal joy just oozing and beaming out of them. They didn't stand on the podium. No one really was there with the tape at the end for them to bust through, but they were a champion, and it always just intrigues me how there's only, you know, one runner, man, woman, that's going to stand on the top of that podium, but they all show up. They 1,000 of them come to the race and they all want to participate, with only a handful of them even expecting to try to win. But everybody goes because there's something internal that happens. There's some joy, some satisfaction, something that occurs within each of us. The endorphins, and oh boy, your book, does it go over some great chemicals that are bathed in our brain and produced from this exercise. Get the book, guys. And this happens to each one of these runners coming through. It's just a lovely thing about our sport and why I think we all just enjoy it so much.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, I think one of the fun things about running marathons, right? I can be a middle-aged, you know, professor, you know, run a completely mediocre time, and yet I'm like, I did something great, you know, and I'm proud of it, right? Whereas, I don't know, there's not that many other things I can be proud of, at least in terms of my body, right? You know, so, and, you know, I grew up, you know, I was one of those kids who hidden, I was like picked last for, I mean, the cliche is true. I really was picked last for every team. I was ashamed of my body as a kid. I once hid in a closet to avoid gym class, you know, I'm just astonished that I've been able to pick this up in midlife and have so much fun out of it and get such pleasure out of it. And yeah, I'm never going to win anything. But I don't care. I enjoy it.
Well, and that's the beauty of this book, Exercise, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do Is Healthy and Rewarding, is it's okay. It's okay that we don't have these feelings that we're jumping out of bed to go running in the morning. It's okay that we're not going to be the one standing on the podium. There are those that definitely want to and deserve to, because they're amazing athletes and we should admire them, I think. But we should also admire that person that came in right before the cutoff of the race, before everybody left to go home. That person is amazing too, and we need to celebrate that.
But if I can add something to that, which is that we also get a distorted view of some of the basic fundamentals of how running works. Like, you know, one of the classic things we are always talking about is this trade-off between speed and endurance, right? You know, the Usain Bolts of the world and the Kipchoges of the world, you know, the sprinters versus the endurance runners. And yet, how many people do you know who can run a 440 mile for 1 mile, right? You may know more people than I do, but you know, they're actually not that many, right? And I think, you know, it turns out that for the rest of us, right, for the people who are not at the extreme end of the you know, the curve, right? That for most of us, there actually is no trade-off. People who are actually better at speed are actually also better at endurance. And in fact, one of the best ways of improving your endurance is to work on your speed, to do a high-intensity interval training, right? And so we kind of get a slightly warped a view of like how the body works and how to train by focusing too much on elite athletes. They're really not relevant to most of us. And I think, sure, it's interesting to look at the extremes of what human beings can do, but it doesn't really tell us that much about average, ordinary, everyday humans. It's more entertainment, I think, than it is actually useful information.
Boy, and I don't want to add to what the author just said, Dan Lieberman, but I think to add to your comment, Scott, I don't think it's okay to sit around. You don't have to be the one up in front on the podium, but you just go do something. Go out and stay moving, stay active, because All the results show that if you stay active, good things happen physiologically and chronologically in your favor as well.
And even those that are over 50, you know, we're in a group right here.
We got four of us. We can add up a pretty high score. If there's, you gather up four people, see if you can beat us.
we have a little running group of older guys. We call ourselves old men on the move.
And we can still nice,
I'll,
do
I'll join you, Dan, next time I visit.
Oh, yeah, you
6 a.m., right? The rest of us there. No, I go slow these days.
Yeah. Actually, we could probably put Dr. Mark on our anchor leg. I think that's what I would prefer. he needs to run the one that's extra long and fast.
Well, we'd like to thank both of our doctors for joining us this evening and to have this discussion about exercise, the knowledge that you dispense. We appreciate it so much. Dan, you've been mentioned on this podcast more than you even know, because so many of the topics, conversations are referenced right back to a lot of your research, and 1,800 times. I don't think we can match what you've been cited in other journals, but we're counted a few of our own. So we appreciate you coming on with us. Mark, we always love having you here. Scott?
And if you're looking for a reason to get up in the morning and go for a run, do like Don and I did. We got the audio version of Dan's book, and that's what kept me going through a training cycle. Was I need to learn that what's in chapter 3? What's in chapter 4? I just saw that there's this one on grandparents. I need to make sure that I get up tomorrow, and that's the only time I could listen to the book was when I was running. So, Dan, thank you very much for putting that carrot out for me.
A huge thank you, Dan.
My pleasure, and I hope we can continue the conversation.
Hey, Dan, if somebody wants to read more or learn more about your writings, where's the best place to go?
My lab website, a lot of the papers that we've published are online. They're, some of them are kind of technical, but you're welcome to give them a go. The Story of the Human Body is also a trade book, so that's popular. Those are two good places to start.
We'll link those in the show notes as well. Dr. Mark, thanks for joining us. Hey, if you need some new shoes, you need anything that is related to running, check out Two Rivers Treads if you live around the area. If you don't, if you're on opposite end of the country, they can get on the phone with you and pick a good running shoe out for you. They're great people that work there, and they ship all around the United States and Canada, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Scott. It's a small business, and with the pandemic, we're hanging in there, keeping our people employed and getting people out running. It's a safe activity when you have to socially distance. All of us loners, you know, it's perfect, right? Go outside, you know, keep away from people. It's good.
Excellent.
Build your immune system. Gets rid of the visceral fat. But no, we're glad to help you. And if you have a local running store, support them. You know, go visit.
And then get out and run.
Maz.
We want to thank you for making Trail Runner Nation the number one running podcast here in North America and in many other countries around the world. Our community becomes stronger and better when we're sharing ideas and knowledge. It takes a team to produce Trail Runner Nation. We want to especially thank our show producer, Doug Mayer, who lives in Chamonix, France, and he runs a cool company called Run the Alps. It's a guide service that will give you the most memorable running vacation you can possibly imagine running through the Alps. Make sure you don't miss this week's Bonus Miles with Dr. Mark Cucuzella, where we talked about a lot of really cool things before the podcast actually started. You can get all of the Bonus Miles as an ambassador-level Patreon sponsor. Run Moss.